This is an ABC podcast.
Ubongia Diana, Munmun Leana, and good fall morning. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong, coming to you live from Nahonaara, now known to many as Honiara, here in beautiful Solomon Islands, as we pay our respect to elders both past and present. Coming up on the show, the world has a new pope, and for the first time, he's an American. Robert Francis Prevost has been elected as Pope Leo XIV after a two-day conclave of cardinals. You'll get more on that breaking news shortly. Also coming up on the show, New Caledonia's giant geckos are under threat.
I've been contacted a number of years ago by the district attorney's office in Los Angeles, who found somebody coming into the U.S. who had, I think, 100 geckos sewn into the lining of their coat.
I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong. You're tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. In breaking news this morning, the world has a new pope. White smoke billowed from the chimney above the Sistine Chapel just after 2 a.m. PNG time. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer was in the crowd in St. Peter's Square when it all happened.
The city of Rome is full of ancient ruins and some of the most iconic structures in the world, but for the last 2 days, all eyes in the city have been on a small, modest makeshift chimney above the Sistine Chapel. And at 11:51 a.m. local time, the crowds started to fill out here in the Vatican Square, and it was black smoke, meaning that the conclave would continue, and the 133 voting cardinals had not reached a two-thirds majority. Then at about 5 p.m. local time, it started to swell again. We saw people come from everywhere. And much to everyone's shock, really, at about 6.09 p.m., we saw white smoke. And there was almost a gasp and then this huge eruption. Profound excitement here at the Vatican Square. We heard the bells tolling, which serves as confirmation that a new pope had been elected. And for about 40 minutes, the crowd had this sort of sense of anticipation and excitement, not knowing who the Pope would be. And then we saw the Cardinal introduce him to the world. Of course, Robert Prevost, an American via Chicago, we'll get a little bit more into his biography shortly. But he greeted the crowd. He was introduced as Pope Leo XIV. And it was at that point it started to go around that it was the first North American that had been elevated to the papacy. And he spoke warmly of Pope Francis. He thanked his fellow cardinals. It was quite an extraordinary moment. And people here, they really felt, they could sense they were a part of history. Let's have a listen to some of them.
Great experience to be here at the very moment it happened. It's terrific.
Did you have a physical reaction when
Yeah, we hugged one another immediately. We're on holidays for a few days, and we hugged one another, and we were...
It's pretty crazy to be here. We're pretty lucky. We study here, and we just arrived, so we haven't been waiting for too long, so it was crazy to experience this, I think. You don't see it too many times in your life.
Robert Prevost, he's a missionary... from Chicago. He spent a lot of time in Peru. He moved there when he was 30, spent most of that time in the northern part of the country. He, of course, served as a missionary, as I mentioned. He's an Augustinian Catholic, and he was seen as a close confidant of Pope Francis, the late Pope Francis. On a lot of social issues, he's seen on the more progressive side of the church. And it's interesting, speaking to Vatican insiders, they see this appointment or this election of Robert Prevost, or now Pope Leo, as a continuity, continuing the legacy of Pope Francis. In fact, he spoke of that in his, I guess, greeting to the crowd today. Let's have a listen to the new Pope, Pope Leo XIV.
Dio ci vuole bene. Dio vi ama tutti.
God loves us, loves you all, and evil will not prevail. We are all in God's hands. Therefore, without fear, united hand in hand with God and each other, let us go forward. Help us too, then each other, to build bridges with dialogue, with encounter, uniting us all to be one people, always in peace.
That was the ABC's Europe correspondent Elias Kloos speaking there from St. Peter's Square. And we continue on with our coverage of the election of the new Pope. Pope Leo XIV has been introduced from the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square. Following the announcement of the Habemus Papam, a Latin phrase which means, "I announce to you a great joy, we have a Pope." The first American Pope walked into the conclave as Robert Francis Prevost and stepped onto the balcony as Pope Leo XIV, his chosen papal name. Now, to speak about what this means for Catholics across the Pacific, I'm joined now by ABC reporter Alice Lolohea. Alice, good morning to you. Are you there?
Good morning, Chris and Rita. It's so good to hear you on the airwaves.
It's so good to hear you this early. Alice, look, how are Catholics around the Pacific feeling this morning with the election of the new Pope?
Oh, there's a general feeling of excitement. We are no longer a papaless church anymore. And I know quite a few family members who are actually in the crowd at the Vatican, you know, eagerly watching that, you know, the chimney for the smoke to finally turn white. So, yeah, there's a general feeling of excitement, but also because, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the first American Pope, this is, you know, another time we're seeing a different country take the throne of St. Peter, be in the papacy. So it's going to be an exciting papacy to watch.
Indeed. And you said you have family members there as well. Have you been able to get in touch with them? And what are they seeing? What's coming out from the other end?
Oh, gosh, my uncle was actually in the crowd and sent through a couple of videos of when Pope Leo XIV actually, you know, came out onto the balcony and spoke to the people for the first time, and seeing all the cheers from the crowd, seeing the Americans, you know, the Americans in the crowd waving their flag very high. There was so much excitement in the atmosphere. It was very electric.
And as you said, you know, the first Pope from America, but what will the Pacific faithful be watching to see and hear from Pope Leo XIV?
I think they'll be wanting to know if he's going to be, you know, continuing on the legacy of Pope Francis, his predecessor. And I think you can perhaps see clues of that in the name that he chose. So Pope Leo, the previous Pope Leo the 13th, back in the day, you know, he was known as the social pope or the pope of the workers. He really championed things like fair wages, labor rights, safer working conditions at a time when people, you know, barely had any workers' rights, right? So I think he's going to be, you know, one of the biggest issues in the world at the moment is definitely, you know, climate change. I think he's going to be continuing on that legacy. So I think that's going to be something we're going to be seeing from this pope.
And what do we know, Alice, of the Pacific's involvement in this new Pope? Like, have we heard from any Pacific cardinals? I remember earlier this week, their socials blew up with the video of one of the cardinals coming out to the Tongans there as well.
Yes, we haven't heard too much from Cardinal Soane Patitamafi from Tonga and Cardinal John Rabat from PNG. But we did actually watch them on the live stream of the cardinals entering the Sistine Chapel, you know, to take their vows of secrecy before, you know, they went in for the conclave. So it was actually really cool to see, you know, that behind the scenes moment of you know, of when they were going into the conclave, because, you know, a lot of this stuff we haven't seen previously in the past. So opening up, you know, all these little rituals and traditions for the public to see was really cool. But very cool to see both, you know, the Tongan and Papua New Guinean cardinal on the international stage, you know, sharing that with everyone else. That was awesome.
Yes, and it must be an opportunity as well for many Pacific Islanders who are there to watch and be there in person. But the late Pope Francis was a faithful leader who involved the Pacific significantly in his papacy. What part of that legacy do the faithful in the region hope that this new pope will continue?
Oh, gosh. You know, Pope Francis, you know, known as the Pope of the Peripheries, he wanted to go and visit all the places where, you know, people of the church hadn't really been visited before by the Pope, hence why we saw his visits to Papua New Guinea, to Timor-Leste just last year. And I think that's one of the things we're perhaps going to see from this Pope as well, because Pope Leo XIV served his time. He's part of the, he's an Augustinian, so he's from the Order of St. Augustine. He served his time in Peru. And so I think we're going to be seeing a little bit more of that from him, but also because he's part of the Order of St. Augustine, they're like big believers, not in poverty, but in sharing and community. And he's spoken about climate change before, and, you know, dominion over nature shouldn't be tyrannical. He wants to see people sharing more of these resources and the wealth of that with one another. So I think that's what we can expect to see from this new pope.
Indeed. And thanks so much, Alice, for sharing with us what this means for Catholics across the Pacific. Really, thank you for your time and for getting up early as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Chrissy.
That was ABC's Alice Lolo here speaking there. And more of this coverage of the new pope will be coming as the day unfolds. Pacific Beat. Welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong, coming to you live from Solomon Islands. Now to New Caledonia, where its giant geckos are the latest sensation in the global pet trade. But conservationists warn their social media-fueled popularity is putting the endangered species at risk. Yasmin Wright-Gittins has this report.
Deep in the forests of New Caledonia lives a unique species of gecko.
The lesser rough-snouted gecko, it's actually a live-bearing gecko that's native to New Caledonia. It's a very rare species in captivity and very rare in the wild as well.
David Utrera is a gecko influencer. He's bred and looked after New Caledonian geckos for more than 15 years, and his YouTube page has more than 100,000 followers. He says in the last few years, there has been huge interest in New Caledonia's geckos.
There has been a big, big boom in interest, especially after COVID. Those COVID years where we saw a big increase in sales for these animals. And I think it's partly because of social media and how easy and how docile they can be.
There are more than 60 native gecko species in New Caledonia, including the largest and some of the rarest gecko species in the world. And they are one of the hottest commodities in the exotic pet trade at the moment. They're targeted by poachers and sold for thousands of dollars online. Dr. Aaron Bauer is a professor of biology at Villanova University and says he's seen how the explosion in popularity online for the geckos has driven rapid poaching growth.
I had been contacted a number of years ago by the district attorney's office in Los Angeles, who found somebody coming into the U.S. who had, I think, 100 geckos sewn into the lining of their coat.
He says the practice of poaching these docile reptiles is putting them at risk.
I know for a fact that one of the species that I described a number of years ago, based on four specimens that occur in an incredibly tiny area of just a few hectares, they are now common in the pet trade. It is disturbing that an animal that we evaluated as being critically endangered, within a few years of discovering this, it was showing up in the pet trade. It gets out through word of mouth.
At the airport in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea, customs official Jislang says they've seen a surge in trafficking.
The trafficking of animals and vegetation across the world is exploding despite the Washington Convention. This form of trafficking represents $20 billion per year, according to Interpol. And at a national level, we have seen around a 30% increase in fraud involving animal species and vegetation.
In 2024, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature listed 75% of New Caledonia's assessed endemic geckos as threatened. noting that some species in particular were under pressure from poaching. At Namir's Zoological Park, manager Marianne Bonzon says locals can unwittingly become complicit in the practice.
There was a video on social networks by some Americans explaining how and where to capture geckos that can only be found on one island. In fact, on the Isle of Pines, there are also people in the area who are accomplices to these people and who are unaware of the importance of protecting our heritage.
She's calling for greater education about the geckos and their value to the country.
That's a genetic heritage, a cultural heritage at every level, and it's important to take part in preserving and protecting it.
And hopes that in time, New Caledonian locals and international influencers will recognise the importance of protecting them.
It's a shame, but we're working on it and that's good. But it takes time. I find that it takes a few generations before we become aware, but we're getting there little by little.
That was Yasmin Wright-Giddens with that report. Yanjo Vinaka, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Ridaumanu-Leong in Solomon Islands. Now to Vanuatu, where its government has marked its first 100 days in office by tabling amendments to the constitution which were passed on Wednesday. One of them is changing the constitution to recognize only males and females. This has sparked concern with human rights groups. Human rights advocates Anne Pakoa says parliament's actions is not only childish, but it violates the UN's conventions that the country has signed.
There are already some conventions that the government has ratified and signed with the United Nations as a member, one of which is the CRC, the Conventions of the Rights of the Child. So that convention sets a benchmark to support, to recognize and to support and to not discriminate any child born in Vanuatu despite their religious background, their cultural background, their social affiliations and their choices in life to whom they would like to be, whether male, female, or other genders. So why would we limit the CRC conventions that we already ratified and signed? If that decision was made because of some strong religious or cultural affiliations, then that is quite discriminating. And as a state member of the United Nations, I really do believe that we can do better than that. You know, Vanuatu is not the only country that is fighting to... Vanuatu is not the only country that is trying to find its way through its development structures, or we're trying to find foot, you know, in our economic status and what we want to do or where we're going. But I really do believe that in order to keep doing what we do and growing stronger and becoming resilient as a nation, we also need to build peaceful societies as well. And what just happened yesterday, the decision that was made, I believe that this is not contributing to building a resilient and peaceful society here in Vanuatu, because that definitely is already creating division, peace conflicts amongst the constituency of men and women, boys and girls who consider themselves neither of the other sex. And so, as a defender, human rights defender, I'm not only shocked, but again, I'll repeat myself that I think the decision that is made was quite childish.
Human rights advocate Anne Pakoa speaking there about the new constitutional amendments to define two sexes in the constitution. Those amendments have been adopted by parliament and will need to be endorsed by Vanuatu's head of state to come into full effect.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Over the past few years, many airlines across the Pacific have been battling to stay afloat. Last year, Vanuatu Airlines went into administration, and in Tonga, its national airline, Lulutai, could be facing a similar fate. Since its inception in 2020, the airline has been at the center of controversy, with alleged mismanagement and ongoing financial issues. And tourism operators in the kingdom say the lack of consistent flights is hitting them hard. The ABC's Tonga reporter Marian Kupu has been following this story.
From July to October each year, the turquoise waters of Vava'u become the stage for one of nature's most majestic migrations, the arrival of humpback whales. It attracts tourists from all over the world. But last year, there was a problem.
2024 was in a good year. We had a very short season. But the flights need to be consistent and make sure the service is there when the people need it, whether it's whale watching or business or any other needs.
That was whale watching charter operator Takitoa Tamoepeau. His business suffered because of a lack of domestic flights. Last year, only one of Lulutai's three planes was operational. Charter flights had to be arranged. But for business owners like Mr. Tamoepeau, it was too little, too late.
So at the moment, and with the current situation politically and the government and all these things which affect something like transportation, flights.
Lulutai was established in 2020 after the collapse of privately owned airline Rio Tonga Limited. Lulutai is government owned and heavily funded by public money. In 2023, Tonga's Retirement Fund Board invested 2.6 million Australian dollars for a 27% stake. Then came a $4 million Australian dollar loan to keep it operational, all from funds meant for workers' retirement savings.
Investment is not to be made for the sake of investment.
Economic commentator Sione Sisita.
The retirement fund should have looked at the most profitable area. Lulutai has no strong profit history. There are far better business options.
Mr. Fifita says the move put political interests ahead of financial responsibility.
Retirement fund is not a social institution to fulfill government social functions and obligations.
A leaked internal presentation in January, obtained by the ABC, reveals an airline reliant on subsidies, battling aircraft shortage, and facing mounting public mistrust. Its SAB 340, a 34-seater aircraft, was grounded in December after colliding with a cement block while taxiing. Maintenance delays added to disruptions. Lulutai has since returned to operating three planes, two owned and one leased. Tonga's Minister for Public Enterprises, Piveni Pikala, says restoring Lulutai's operations is a priority. But he admits financial transparency is an issue. with 3 years of audit report still incomplete. And last month, the airline required a $1.3 million Australian loan from the government to stay afloat.
As for me, I am very satisfied with where Lulutai is at right now in terms of gaining confidence of the public to travel, in terms of all the fleet is operational. But the financial part is where we are still struggling.
This week, the government confirmed two parties have expressed interest in going into business partnership with Lulutai. An insider suggests the government is looking to Fiji Airways, one of the few profitable airlines in the region, for advice. Former Prime Minister Celso Sovaleni, who was pushed out of office in part because of issues surrounding Lulutai, says he has always maintained that expanding the fleet or looking for partners is the only way forward.
Lulutai need to actually lease or buy a plane to actually meet the extra demand, and at the same time ensure that the airline will be profitable going into the future. It doesn't really matter who is going to run it, but that option should be considered.
But back in Lava'u, whale watch operators like Mr. Tamoy Piao just want Tonga's government to listen to business owners and act with the best interests at heart.
I always believe in communication and to hear from the people who are in the water, who are doing all these things. And because you don't just sit in the office and assume and expect, oh, okay, they are doing. No.
Takitoa Tau Moepeau, whale watching charter operator. Ending that report there from Marian Kupu in Tonga. It's been defunct for decades, but the Panguna mine continues to cast a long shadow over Bougainville's future and its people's desire for independence from Papua New Guinea. Local opposition to the gold and copper mine's environmental impacts sparked a civil war in the 1990s that claimed thousands of lives. Despite that, the Bougainville government sees its reopening as the key to funding independence from PNG. That plan is threatened, though, by a class action involving more than 5,000 claimants seeking compensation from mining giant Rio Tinto and its subsidiary Bougainville Copper Limited for the alleged historic mismanagement of the mine. Meanwhile, Rio Tinto funded an independent assessment of the mine's social and environmental impacts that involved widespread community consultation. Landowner and Member of Parliament for the Eora constituency, where the Panguna mines are located, Theonila Roca Matbob, told Lucy Cooper that Rio Tinto provided no clear commitments in their most recent AGM.
From a reactive standpoint, I'd say it's actually disappointing, but getting to know the period of time that we've dealt with Rio Tinto, you know, back in the mining days coming up, it is expected that that's the behavior of the company, so it did not really come by surprise.
Can you set the scene for us? What is life like right now for the community around the mine?
It is devastating, to be, you know, to be frank. And living in a mess that is created by a corporate company without the consent and without the consent of the traditional landowners or the guardians of the land, life, you know, this is the life people are living, which they don't deserve. And it is not an easy thing to keep reminding the company that knowingly created the mess, that this is the kind of thing we're living in. I mean, in terms of describing what we're living with, is something that, you know, continue to hurt people. So, while it's devastating, we don't want to talk about it because it's so hard to talk about things that you're living and that you have to go 10 miles ahead of a normal, I mean, as compared to a normal community that lives on real arable land and to survive, right? Like there's no extra effort that needs to be invested because there's land, there's water, there's all of these basics that a person needs for survival. But for people like us and a lot more, like people from different domains of the mind, it's so devastating that every single day, instead of them worrying about their children's savings, they're worried about the water that they will drink in the afternoon. So that is the life that people are living.
So the Mine Legacy Impact Assessment came out in November and it found various forms of human rights abuse, environmental problems. What do you want done with this assessment? What would you like to see come of it?
The writing is now on the wall. The basis on which Bougainville fought is not an assumption anymore, but it is on record. It is in black and white that it was not an assumption, but what people accused the company of was very true, that they literally polluted the environment, the land, the river systems and the environment. I know for sure that Rio was fully aware of this from the very beginning, that they had a mess to fix. And the commitment is not there, the frustration is not there, but it does not remove the passion from the people that, whether it be my generation or the next generation, will continue to push and call for justice until it is served. Because to begin with, I can't even remember in my family historical stories that my leaders paddled from here to Victoria to call for the company to come and mine the land and poison the land and the environment and the water systems.
Rio Tinto is focused on forming a roundtable to deal with things highlighted in the assessment. Do you agree that it's a step in the right direction?
It is. Maybe to them, maybe to Rio Tinto, it is a step towards the right direction. But to me, it is a step towards undermining the process through a deliberate move for duplication.
Is there a price, or shall we say a number, that you think is fair for Rio Tinto to pay to the people of Bougainville for the damage done?
I cannot be able to put the price because it is life. It is life that has been undermined, that has been threatened, that has been poisoned. It's invaluable, and I cannot put a price tag to a termination of life, because when you undermine or poison the land, you are killing a generation or two or three, or permanently for that matter.
Land owner and Member of Parliament for the Yoro constituency, Theonila Roka Matbob. And time for some sports now. The group stage of the OFC Women's Champions League continues in Tahiti today with a rerun of last season's grand final when the title holders Auckland United take on Hekari United from Papua New Guinea. When they met in the decider in Honiara last year, there was almost nothing between the two sides, with the New Zealanders winning by a solitary goal to nil. Both teams have warmed up for the rematch with thumping wins in their first group games. Auckland defeating host Club Pirai 11-0, while Hekari went one better, beating Panzer from American Samoa 12-0. So what can we expect from this latest encounter? We're joined by the OFC's media manager, Matt Brown, from Stade Pater, where the big game kicks off in about an hour from now. Matt, welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. Now, a rerun of last year's final that was held here in Honiara Solomon Islands, but another tight contest in prospect. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. Auckland United were incredibly impressive in their opening win over the hosts. You mentioned that, you know, 11-0 margin. They were fantastic from the outset, and they really tore AS Pirae to shreds at time with their quick passing, their skills, and certainly their shooting was right on target. And they have a lot of depth in their squad because their best striker, who's been their sort of talismanic player, Renee, she was injured in a freak accident at training where she had to go and have surgery on a finger after a ball was sort of volleyed into her hand. And so she's effectively out of the tournament. So they've had to do without her, but they spread the goals around. And Zoe Benson scored, I think, 4 or 5 goals in that game, really did step up. So they have a lot of firepower. Do the Auckland United side, who have gone something like, prior to a defeat on a midweek game before they travelled to Tahiti, they'd gone 56 matches in all competitions unbeaten. The Auckland United side's a real dominant force in New Zealand women's football. And Hakati Women's FC, equally dominant in PNG football. They are a strong side. They are, I think, the closest to Auckland United at this tournament. I expect these two teams, regardless of the outcome today, to probably meet again in the final. There will be one or two other teams may have a say in that. But Hikari, I think they will be stronger than they were last year, but they need to be because Auckland are definitely better. They've acclimatised to the conditions here well. You're in Honiara. We know how hot it is there. Every time you walk outside, it's like going into an oven, whereas it's a bit cooler here. Although the temperature's quite warm, it is certainly cooler. Slightly drier heat, not as humid as it is in Honiara, and the New Zealanders have adjusted to those conditions. The big thing for Hikari Women's FC, they have their architect, playmaker in midfield, Ramona Pardio, back. She didn't play in the Champions League last year, so she adds a bit of steel in their midfield, but they're really going to rely on their talismanic centre-forward, Mari Kaipu, to do the damage in front of goal for any chances they get. They've got to be more clinical. Their coach, Ericsson Kameng, essentially said, look, we may have scored a lot against Pansar in their opening game from American Samoa, but we missed more chances than we scored. So in a game which should be a lot tighter, they will have to be clinical if they're wanting to turn the tables on Auckland United.
Certainly, Matt, and it's just one of those days as well. Like you mentioned here in Honiara, one of those days today with the heat and humidity. But, you know, Hikari have two big names you mentioned there. Prolific goal scorer for PNG, Ramona Pardio, and we have Andilitia Mbakanideva, who has captained Fiji's national team. So could this inclusion further boost Hikari to edge over Auckland this time?
Yeah, Bakanevela from Fiji. You're right, she's captain of the Fiji national team and she adds a bit of steel to experience. So they're definitely stronger. I thought in their opening game they were a little bit sloppy at times. They really, they put Pansar to the sword. Pansar making their debut in the tournament. Clearly at this level, they're not quite there yet. It's their first really time travelling outside of American Samoa. So they'll learn from the experience, but they are minnows in the sense that we have two powerhouse teams here in women's football, which you've got to remember is really still developing in the region. A big impetus, big boost from the football, the FIFA World Cup that was held in New Zealand and Australia in 2023. OFC's invested a lot into the development of women's football, but it is very much in that development phase. And there are some clubs, that, you know, there is still a big gap in terms of the standards from the top clubs in the region to some of the lesser teams. And so hence we get some of these mismatches during the tournament. But I think the likes of these two teams, bar Women FC, who had a good win first up over the Henderson Eels side from the Solomon Islands, who also, you know, had a decent win over Tupapa. You know, the top three or four teams can be extremely competitive, but there is, you know, a bit of a drop-off after that.
Yeah, those are the top teams there, Matt. But there is another game later today when host club Pirae play Pansar. But regardless of who wins, their prospects of making the semi-finals would appear to be slim at this stage.
Yeah, because they've got to play, still got to play Hikari Women's FC. So Pere, I would expect them to beat Pansar and get to 3 points. And it may, and then that will probably, because I do think Auckland United will win today, but that's, you know, I could be proven wrong. And if that does happen, of course, they would go to 6 points and qualify for the semi-finals. And it will set up a showdown on Sunday, Tahiti time, Monday, your time, between Hikari Women's FC and AS Pere for that second semi-final berth. And based on what I saw on the opening day, I think Hikari would be favourites. But the thing about Pere, they have some very good technical players. They understand football, and they were just, you know, beaten by a faster clinical side with a lot more experience in Auckland United. So I think Pere, you know, certainly in a match where there will be some nerves from both sides, if they keep the score level, the longer it goes on, it can frustrate a team like Hikari United FC. And you know, the 2023 Champions League, the inaugural one for OFC, was held in Port Moresby. Hikari were the favourites for that. And in the very opening game, they got frustrated by the team from New Caledonia, AS Academy Feminine, who won in the 8th minute of injury time. And effectively, you know, it was a round-robin format in the first edition of the championship, and they won the tournament. So, you know, football's a funny game, and anything can happen. And just because you're the big favourites, doesn't always mean you win.
That's right. Football can be a funny game as well, and anything can happen. You know, with a lot of football fans here in Solomon Islands as well can relate to that. You know, results so far would suggest that the semi-final lineup would feature Auckland, Hikari, Bar from Fiji, Henderson Eels probably from Solomon Islands. But what are your thoughts on likely winners of the tournament from that list?
Yeah, well, Auckland United FC, I should say. We have in Auckland, and just to digress slightly, we have an Auckland City Football Club. We have Auckland United FC. We have Auckland FC, of course, the new A-League team as well. So apologies for that faux pas. But yeah, Auckland United FC, definitely the favourites to win the tournament. They look strong as defending champions. They're better than they were last year. So whoever's challenging them has to step up. And Hikari would appear to be the biggest challenger on paper. They are one team that is capable. You know, Port Moresby is quite similar to Honiara in terms of the humidity and heat. And one thing about the Pacifica teams, they certainly are more used to these kind of conditions. It can affect the Kiwis who, you know, are playing in temperatures of around 17, 18 degrees back home compared to the high 20s here. So, you know, fatigue can be a factor, but I do think they do look extremely fit and prepared. So they would be those two are the favourites to be in the final. But Bar Women FC, they were clinical on the counter-attack yesterday against Henderson Eels FC, and they've got some fine attacking players, some Fiji internationals as well. And I think they could certainly, you know, in a semi-final, if this, for example, they meet Hikari, it could be a reasonably even match, and it wouldn't be a foregone conclusion that the Port Moresby side makes the final. But I do see Auckland United getting through to the final. I just do think they'll be too strong for whoever they meet in the other group.
Indeed. And look, that's all we really have time for. We really appreciate your time. It sounds like a very busy schedule you have going on there, but many thanks, and enjoy the Auckland Hikari game, and that should be a good one.
Yeah, thanks very much. Quick plug, if anyone listening wants to watch it, you can watch it live on FIFA Plus, free for everybody.
All right, thanks so much. That was Matt Brown there, OFC's media manager, on the line from State Petter in Tahiti. And that, of course, brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. A reminder of our top story this morning: the world has a new pope. And for the first time, he's an American. Robert Francis Prevost has been elected as Pope Leo XIV. Also in New Caledonia, giant geckos are the latest sensation in the global pet trade. But conservationists warn their social media-fueled popularity is putting the endangered species at risk. Look, you can catch up on all the stories today online at ABC Radio Australia and on ABC Pacific. Agitu Paul will be back again, same time next week. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia. Up next is news, followed by Nigeria Daily.